Hello, everyone, and welcome to Risky Business. I'm Patrick Gray. This week's show is brought to you by Vericode. If you want to make sure your application code won't be a liability, you might want to go and have a look at their website. It's vericode.com. Now, a couple of housekeeping matters before we get started on this week's show. First up, our forums are now open. You do not need to be an account holder to contribute. Basically, we're throwing open the gates and waiting for the horrible flame wars and sort of cesspool-y vibe to form. Woot. So get in there, start flaming each other, start flaming me, let's go nuts. Now, also, just another little housekeeping thing. A lot of people have been asking me, both in the forums and out, why I actually bleep out swear words from this podcast. Now, it's not that I think that you have delicate little ears. There's a couple of reasons. One is, I don't want to be one of those people who swears a lot because he thinks it makes him cool. So that's one reason. I just don't want to be gratuitous. And the other reason is a lot of people listen to this podcast on their home stereos, and that means their kids are around and they don't want to hear our filthy, filthy language. So, you know, the beeps stay. I'm sorry about that, but I hope you understand. You know, there's a lot of people out there, little kids, sensitive ears. Anyway, on this week's show, we are joined by an extremely special guest, not just a very special guest, an extremely special guest, Mr. Brian Snow. Now, until his retirement, Brian was the Technical Director of Information Assurance for the United States National Security Agency, which, obviously in our field, that's a pretty impressive job title. In other words, he knows a few things about information security, this guy. He does. And in this week's show, we cover a bunch of stuff with him, everything from Google's recent troubles in China to e-voting to crypto trust models and much, much more. It's fascinating stuff, and that's coming up after the news. In this week's sponsor interview with Vericode's Tyler Shields, we have a chat about BlackBerry proof-of-concept spyware that he created and demoed at ShmooCon. So apparently it's still not too hard to get custom malware installed onto the BlackBerry, and Tyler will join us for a chat about that. He's actually created a nice little Swiss Army Trojan that does a bit of data exfiltration, you know, track you with your GPS, all that sort of stuff. Good stuff coming up later. But right now it's time for a check of the week's news headlines with Adam Boileau. And Adam, we always hear the Twitter generation crapping on about how awesome their latest app that allows them to share their location with each other and maybe meet up for coffees because they happen to be within two blocks and it's all awesome and geolocation awesomeness. But some guys have taken the piss out of that and released an awesome website called pleaserobme.com.
The website pulls together people's tweets and other location-aware data and figures out when they're not at home. And then provides an easy list of people who are not there, so you can go ahead and rob them.
That sounds awesome. I mean, I like robbing people.
Oh, as do I, of course.
It's an excellent way to acquire expensive stuff without actually having to pay for it.
Yes, also prison tattoos.
Nice. I mean, what do you make of this? Because, you know, depending on who you talk to, geo-aware applications are either the most awesome thing on the planet or they're just, you know, horrifyingly creepy. I mean, there's no middle ground.
Well, I think maybe it's not mutually exclusive. There's a bit of both. I mean, there's certainly some places where geolocation tools are very, very useful. I mean, obviously, location-aware mapping on your mobile device for searching is really handy, and being able to find other people, you know, having your friends list, you know, around town, be able to, you know, see where you are, which pub you're at, without having to bother sending your text to us. I guess that's kind of a useful thing. But on the other hand, yeah, the privacy implications are pretty brutal. But then on the other hand, you know, we're giving away so much other, you know, so many other bits of important information, and you have so little relative privacy, I guess, compared to what we used to. But yeah, is it a big change knowing exactly where you are versus having to read someone's tweets and figure out based on their twit pics where they are?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think there is one solution, though, that I can think of. Rottweilers.
Rottweilers, yeah. So if you could geolocate your Rottweiler, that would be handy, yeah.
Well, no, you just leave the Rottweiler at home, right? And then when they go around to rob you, the Rottweiler eats the robber.
Right, and then the Rottweiler posts twit pics of the corpse?
Of the corpse in little pieces.
Rockin', yeah, no, that yeah. Sounds like a plan. And what, the rottweilerchewed.com.
Nice. Anyway, moving on to other news. And a US cyclist, a competitive cyclist in the United States, has been accused of computer hacking. Tell us about this one.
Oh, no. So apparently, in what is actually a pretty hilarious story, he has broken into the French cycling's anti-doping agency where they do testing to see if you've been taking drugs. When you're, you know, on the Tour de France or whatever. And apparently he, This guy won the Tour de France in 2006 and then was stripped of his medal because he tested positive for testosterone. And now he hacked them and was apparently attempting to mess with their results so that he could claim that their tests were inconclusive or, you know, were flawed, and that maybe he could get his medal back, which I think is, that's some pretty lateral thinking there, guy.
I bet they were confused when they found some blood in his steroid stream.
Yeah, exactly.
These Tour de France guys, I mean, they love their juice, you know, and I'm not talking about apples.
Hell no. Yep, they're high and tight, so he likes them.
So that's kind of interesting. You know, he's got cycling skills. He's got computer hacking skills. He's got nunchuck skills.
And got the little roid craze going on.
Yeah, so there you go. Interesting. Cyclist turned hacker. But moving on to more important things. Now, Microsoft, as we know, spend a lot of time doing QA on their patches, and they have to test for all sorts of combinations and permutations of software. But occasionally a patch goes out that blue screens people. And it seems to have been the case recently with the latest update affecting users of XP. Now, the funny part of this, Adam, is...
Apparently, the blue screen is the result of an interoperability issue with a piece of malware.
Isn't that brilliant? I love how all these users are complaining, going, bloody Microsoft, you know, you should have tested your patch. It's like, what? You want us to do QA by testing our patches on computers that are infected with malware to make sure that it's not, like, screwing up your keylogger guy? What?
Well, I mean, to be honest, to be a realistic in an environment, they probably do need to test their patches on machines with malware. Surely their test lab has enough compromised machines in it.
Oh, dude, it's just like, it is pretty funny though, isn't it? When everyone's kind of going off at him, and then it's like, guy, you're infected with like malware and shit.
Yeah, that is a very, very funny story. And I bet some of the Microsoft guys are just face palming.
Yeah, exactly. But funnily enough, there were some kind of loose reports that it affected Win7, but I think that might have been coincidental or something. I don't know. It seems to just affect XP, but no big deal. I mean, you know, clean up your shit and then reinstall the patch. Now, this next story, in terms of like massively overstating stuff, this came to my attention, I think it was late last week, actually. Some UK researchers did some very interesting work in looking at chip and pin, and they've actually figured out a way with the EMV standard to use a stolen card and actually, without knowing the pin, be able to do a fraudulent transaction. Now, this is very, very cool stuff. The problem with this story, though, is it's been written up everywhere as chip and pin broken.
Right, and I'm not aware of the actual specific technical details of the attack, but I mean, the guys involved, I mean, Ross Anderson is a pretty well-respected guy. He's written a couple of seminal books and been involved in this stuff for a long time. So, I mean, typically, if Ross Anderson's saying the stuff's bust, then I'm generally going to go with, yeah, sure, it's bust.
Oh, well, no one's disputing the fact that they can actually use these cards with incorrect pins, right? Using this,
yep.
It seems to be a fairly complicated attack. So, okay, the pin component of chip and pin, okay, it appears to be broken. But they're not saying that they can actually copy or clone the cards. I mean, that to me is what would say this stuff is broken. If you can actually read from the protected storage area of the smart cards that are used on these things, used for these things, then you've got a real problem. Okay, so you can use stolen cards by getting around the pin. Okay, that's bad.
Yeah, that is a pretty important attack. I mean, stolen cards are quite a common occurrence.
Of course they are. Of course they are. But wouldn't you say card not present fraud is a little bit more of a problem?
Probably, yes. But
wouldn't
then
you say the cloning of magstripe cards is a little more of a problem?
Yeah. But this is also the way that we're meant to be moving as a future, in the future to address a bunch of those issues. And the idea is that we're going to reduce the amount of card not present fraud.
Yeah, but this doesn't affect card not present fraud.
If we are successful in reducing card not present fraud, it should increase the pressure on card present fraud.
Mm.
I guess we need robust mechanisms to prevent card present fraud from taking up the slack that's being left by increased card not present or decreased card not present fraud.
Yeah, now look, I'm not arguing that this isn't awesome research, right? I'm just saying chip and pin isn't broken and, the floodgates of fraud. You know, the headline seems to suggest that we're in a similar position to where we were with Magstripe, and that's just not true.
Yeah, okay, and fair enough, except that the headlines are probably a bit sensationalised, sure.
Okay, thank you. But anyone who wants to go and look at that research, it's pretty easy to find. There's a PDF, it's all good stuff. Go check it out. Very, very, very interesting research. But chip and pin, not broken, okay? Now, moving on, someone who is broken is Max Vision, a.k.a. Max Butler. This is a guy who ran, Carter's Market? This is an online carding forum. He spectacularly took over another forum and like pwned all their stuff and stole all of their members. So yeah, he was like a real underground player. Now he eventually got busted. He's been sentenced to 13 years in prison.
Yeah, and that's a lot of time. I mean, that's what the longest sentence handed down to a computer criminal in the US so far.
Yeah, but Gonzalez will probably take the honor when he's sentenced in the next couple of months.
I'm sure that's not a particularly big condolence to the guy.
Yeah, but I mean, look, he was doing some pretty naughty things. He was caught with 1.8 million stolen credit card numbers belonging to 1,000 different banks, and there were charges on the cards of 86.4 million.
Yeah, there's certainly no doubt this guy was carrying out real crime. But what I think is interesting about the story is, I mean, obviously, you know, the dude is ethically challenged, but he was put in jail some years ago, I think, and as a result met some real criminals and then started actually carding, whereas previously he hadn't been carrying out actual, you know, real crime, I mean, not in the sense of you know, proper carding and making serious money.
Well, you know, the Australian Federal Police that I know that I've met through my work have come from all sorts of disciplines, including, you know, counterterrorism, narcotics, whatever. They refer to prisons as crime universities.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And I think, you know, you put, relatively young, technically talented, but not, you know, particularly bad computer criminals in jail, then, and being surprised when they get out and actually, you know, start carrying out real fraud with, you know, in concert with other real criminals, that's, you know... That's exactly what you'd expect, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, they go off to prison and people tell them, hey, you know, you can make money with this stuff, right?
Although he didn't appear to have made a whole load of fat cash, according to the report.
According to the court, up to $1 million, I mean,
in the context of 86 million cards, it's not a whole bunch of money.
Sure, but how much money did you make in the last 2 years, Adam?
Yeah, not that much.
Me neither, unfortunately. You know, God willing, that will change.
You send checks through risky.biz.
Yes, that's right. Anyway, now, this is a news item that you actually IM'd me a couple of days ago, which I think is rather depressing. Can you please tell us what it is, Adam?
So, yeah, a report came out based on some research by the company Trustea, and they've gone through the stats of number of exploits carried out in the last couple of years which use Acrobat or Flash, and then have graphed the changes over time. And it's really interesting because it suggests that up to 80% of exploits in the last year have been related to Acrobat, Adobe Acrobat and the PDF format. And they actually have an interesting graph which shows the number of systems which have Acrobat installed but not patched, Acrobat installed but patched, and Acrobat not installed. And it's something like 83% of machines have unpatched Acrobat. Yes. So you can certainly see why it's being used. But this is we don't really often see really good hard metrics like this in the security industry. And I think it's a very important thing for people to look at and go, right, we need to prioritize how we are defending our organizations, right? It's not necessarily about firewalls on the perimeter. It's about making sure your damn clients are patched and not just Microsoft software, like the third party and especially goddamn Adobe products.
What is it with Adobe making such crap software? I mean, honestly, PDF Reader has got to be the biggest pile of shit ever to run on Windows.
It's pretty fat and bloated these days.
It's always been fat and bloated. It has always been fat, bloated, and shit. And it just hangs around in memory, just soaking up all of your page. It's f***ing horrible.
Yeah, and then the browser plugin's pretty bad too. Yeah.
Oh, like, dude,
the Flutter provocation.
Flash.
Yeah, well, Flash. Yeah, and then it's Flash. Although, in their defense, they did buy that off Macromedia.
Yeah, they did, but I mean, they just made it worse. I mean, it used to only take up 80% of my CPU trying to display a banner ad. Now it's more like 95%.
Well, that's why you have 8 cores now, right?
Oh, man.
So you have 8 instances of Flash running.
Flash is just horrible. At least I know how to kill a process. But, you know, you think about all these people out there who's like, you know, why is my computer all of a sudden stuffed? It's because of Flash. It's because of Flash. Or it's because of Adobe Reader. Adobe, you suck.
I concur. Our official opinion, you suck. And your security response procedures leave a lot to be desired.
Yes, in keeping with our stern phrasing there. But, you know, interesting anyway. And anyone who wants to read that report, it was a ZDNet report, or ZDNet if you're an American, ZZ. It's called Malicious PDF Files Comprised 80% of All Exploits for 2009. So you shouldn't have too much trouble finding that with your Google foo.
And it has pretty graphs to show your pointy head, boss.
It does. It does. Put it in a PowerPoint thing and say...
Hell, put it in two.
Put it in too. There we go. All right, Adam. Well, on that rather depressing note, we're going to leave it. But thank you for joining us for the news, and we'll chat to you again next week.
Yeah, sure will, Pat.
That was Adam Boileau with a look at the week's news headlines. And now it's time for our special very special, as you heard me say in the intro, a very special feature interview with Brian Snow, the former Technical Director of Information Assurance with the NSA in the United States. Now, with every single man and his dog weighing into all sorts of topics they don't understand, like the Google versus China thing, I thought it'd make sense to get someone on the show who actually is qualified to talk about such things, at least from a general perspective, you know, not specifics per se, but, you know, this is a guy who's been inside the sausage factory of the intelligence community, and, you know, he's seen all the mysterious stuff that goes on in there, and he's got perspective on this stuff, shall we say. So, you know, I'd rather listen to what Brian has to say about this stuff than some executive from an anti-malware company, you know, one of those guys with capped teeth that you meet at press events when they come to Australia on their own private jets, you know, and they start telling you about asymmetric attacks and stuff like they're spy masters. They annoy me. Anyway, Brian's not one of those guys. He's the real deal. And he joined me via Skype earlier this week for a chat. So Brian started off by explaining his theory of this thing that's building at the moment called a trust bubble. So just as the trading of collateralized debt obligations led to the GFC, excessive misplaced trust may lead to the bursting of what Brian calls a trust bubble. It's very interesting stuff. Now, this interview starts interesting and ends up fascinating. So bear with it and enjoy.
Here in the United States, we've recently had a fairly severe financial flap that has put millions out of work, has had trillions of dollars worth of value evaporate. Now, much of this credit bubble collapse was caused by excessive trading in credit derivatives, which was putting together poor risk items, bundling them together with a few good risk items, and letting them carry the label of a high quality stuff for bargaining purposes, for setting market prices, without adequately addressing the risk or letting consumers know, nor did they ask the brokers and stuff who were buying this stuff. And eventually it blew up. There was no real substance underneath it. It was inflated. Many people ran away with profits, so be it. But it was ephemeral and evaporated out of the economy at large and came out of the pocket of the taxpayers because the systems were too complex and the people didn't really understand what they were getting into. And so it led to a bubble and poof. Many people are really weeping and hurting with it now, and it's also hitting the global economy as well. The reason I mention this, because this lack of understanding of the complexity of the situation has an exact parallel in the security business. Providing security for complex systems is a very delicate task. And so we've laid on lots of things, cryptography, other sorts of mechanisms out there have been talked about, to give people the ability to trust. And much of this is enforced by certificates, which people can get and play with, but nobody understands them. They don't understand the risks they are taking. So I am willing to predict now a major, what I will call, trust bubble episode blowing up in our face within the next 3 to 5 years, possibly the next 18 months, just as severe as the credit crunch, as people begin to understand the nature of the attacks that they are subject to and what is going on.
What does this look like, though? What does this breakdown resemble?
It can come on so many paths, I have no idea, and it'll be a surprise when it hits, just the way the credit derivatives were a surprise, because they came out of that which was unknown and unanalyzed, but used. And the trust stuff will be the same. It'll come on from something that everybody just trusted, but it was not analyzed, but widely used.
Yeah.
That will be that'll be the signature of it. But if there's so many places it can pop up, I can't point to one.
Well, it's interesting that you just said that. And the analogy for me just clicked when you said that it's, you know, that it's widely used and complicated and not understood, yet everyone expects that it's going to be fine.
Bingo. That's the risky business.
Nice.
But let's get in a little more detail on what we can do to mitigate or try to reduce these sorts of concerns. And that's to pay more attention to what some of the leading researchers have been telling us for some time. There is a very good paper by Andrew Odlitsko. The paper by Andrew Odlitsko is Providing Security with Insecure Systems. That's Odlyzko, Andrew Odlitsko. He's with the School of Mathematics at the University of Minnesota. That should help people track it down. The basic idea he gets across in this is that the current systems we're working with today, security systems, are too fragile for the types of problems they're being asked to handle. We're using computers for exactly the reasons they were built. They let things be done cheaper, and they let things be done faster. But cheap and fast isn't always secure. Some things that are important require that you slow down and think a bit before you actually act.
But that's not the way commerce works, is it?
Bingo. That's why they won't learn the lesson. They'll take the beating and then crawl back into bad habits within another 3 to 5 years, even after they take the beating. That's why it may not be a long-range solution. But there are approaches out there, and they may not be all that terrible. Alisco gives one example of a voting system. Electronic voting is very fast and easy if you trust it. You can make your vote, walk away, it can be automatically tallied. The major news services will have all the votes added together, and they make their projections much sooner. And can you catch the cemetery votes? Can you catch abuse? It'll be just as hard with the regular stuff, unless you build in robust audit mechanisms as well, ideally enforceable or at least triggerable by the individual who cast the vote. So if I cast a vote, it'd be nice to give me a paper copy of what I actually voted and a hash of it in some sense that can be tested with a registry, and I can go check an audit site later to make sure that my vote, or at least its hash, was recorded as being valid. And then others can run software over that, over the whole vote packet, to see if my hash matched and if it was added in for independent verification. Other mechanisms for allowing checks where you're mixing social processes, things humans know how to do as human beings, with automated processes, which will do bank transactions, need to run. Ross Anderson, a very noted British security architect, if you will, has written on this topic repeatedly on banking trust and industry. And you can have automated transactions where you can call over the telephone or over the internet to move money from account to account and do stuff. And you're probably safe in many cases with just a check, pardon me, a password permission and stuff. But it's far more robust, especially if it's large amounts of money or you're really paranoid about it, if it has two-factor or three-factor authentication and independent channels for verification. You might quickly log on, give your credentials, a password, whatever, do the transaction online, but it is not yet accepted until an independent path back to you, your cell phone or your phone number, calls, and it can be an automated call saying, "We have just received a message to transact X dollars from account Y to account Z. If you intended this action to be taken, please push 1. Otherwise, push 2." Boom. That's also fast and automated, but it's independent. It's another path that the attacker might not have been able to get to. So it's not a complete solution, but it's a mitigation.
It's interesting that you use this example because I've also long been a believer that it is possible to create secure transaction systems from insecure components. You know, it is absolutely doable. But then the thing that concerned me about the whole Google China thing is we're looking at state-sponsored group. Well, you know, what has been described as state-sponsored groups, we don't really know that. That seems to be an assumption on behalf of the media. And they're going after intellectual property. Now, this is just soft data that has to sit somewhere either in memory or on disk. And it's a lot harder to protect with those insecure components than a transaction is. You can sort of design a process for a secure transaction, whereas designing a process for the safe storage of data that needs to be accessed by multiple groups, multiple departments, multiple people, that seems very hard. And that seems to be the area where we're most likely to fall down in 10 years. Would you agree with that?
Yes. And let's use common language. You call it hard, I call it complex. And it's the com but we're saying the same thing. It's the complexity that causes the problem of providing the appropriate protection mechanisms. And they're not impossible, they're just much harder and therefore far more ripe for error, especially if they're not robust design procedures in place with formal methods and other things used to test the code. In other words, that the purveyor of these more complex systems actually put in the effort required to get there. And that comes to another mitigation factor that we can throw in, whether it's bank transactions or voting systems, whatever. The designers of these systems have to put in more effort than they have so far in knowing they've done the job right. Also, something that really troubles me and that really sort of, to my mind, gives a stamp of why they are clumsy with this, they really ignore security to the last minute. They have this fear of zero-day attacks. Everybody worries about the zero-day attack that can get them. What is a zero-day attack? It is code mature enough to actually cause damage. It can run and hurt you, and you see it on the first day, and man, you're damaged. They fail to tell you that that zero-day attack takes advantage of a vulnerability that has often been reported for months or years in the literature. And since no one has used that vulnerability, they don't bother fixing it.
Now, this is a topic that we got into last week during the sponsor interview, which is, you know, whether or not vendors are currently doing a good enough job of patching their stuff.
Easy answer. No. If some companies, Microsoft gets lots of messages privately from people who have what they think is a vulnerability. Sometimes it is, sometimes it's not. Microsoft can evaluate. But if they don't see it actually being used in attack, they don't fix. It comes out later in a patch. So they are buying at that time by not doing the effort to counter the vulnerability before someone starts attacking it. They save some money, but then they cost themselves time of being vulnerable until they get the patch in place later once a zero day is launched. Now, what is the problem with this? They're a big vendor. If they would patch their stuff first, they wouldn't be the first target to fall, or anybody who is doing this bit of let's lay back and wait till we're attacked to respond. That's a wrong attitude in my mind, because you will be attacked because you are vulnerable. Some of your competitors, if they choose a more positive stance, and it costs money, and I'm not asking them to go way overboard the way the government does to protect in military systems, just do enough to keep ahead of the pack of your competitors being lazy. If you're stopping some of the vulnerabilities, when the zero day emerges, it will not hit you. It will hit your commercial opponents, and they will take the hit, not you, and you get a commercial advantage. So there's payback eventually. It is not sunk cost. Now, and I'm not trying to pick on Microsoft, please. They happen to be a big target, so everybody shoots there first, okay? I'm really not trying to pick on them, but on an attitude that they share with the rest of the industry. And I'm looking to a few industry leaders to start doing interesting things that can help with security. And sometimes it can redound to your benefit, and this is a case where I think it would. It'd make them more robust, or whoever chooses this path first. And as far as can people be forward, all I'm calling this is be forward-leaning on security. Don't be laid back waiting to be hit. And you forward-lean as much as you can afford. Mm-hmm. And it is a cost trade-off decision you have to make, but if you just lean a little bit, you won't be the first victim.
Well, that actually brings me on to my next bunch of questions here, Brian, which is, it was brought to my attention recently that there's been a bit of a spat in the Mozilla community over the inclusion of CNNIC, that's China's Network Information Center. Apparently, CNNIC now has a root cert in Firefox. It also has a root cert in Internet Explorer. So now this is a Chinese organization, and as we know, organizations in China are always directly report. You know, they report directly to the government. The government controls everything, and this has got a lot of people quite concerned that this will enable the Chinese government to man in the middle connections to pretty much any SSL box on the planet.
It will make it easier. It's not an automatic win, but it certainly makes it much easier to come in on certain paths, yes. And so it devolves again to who do you trust? Who do you want, Microsoft or Entrust or others, to include in their root certificate registry that will bless stuff coming in for attribution? That's what I was getting at. People are confusing trust with attribution. The certificate structure is a fine way of finding out who did what to you. It doesn't say that they should be trusted to do it. And so if you really want a trust model in place, they ought to allow editing tools for some, at least, commercial clients, if not home clients, to go through and delete some of those certificates from the registries that are loaded in the machine automatically with an operating system for your convenience. All this is for commercial convenience. And the more certificates you put in, the more widely your machine can be used to touch bases around the world and actually communicate and deal with them. But do you really want to be doing that?
Well, the thing is, though, I mean, Brian, if you're working for a large Australian mining company and you're doing some business in Beijing, and your webmail certificate all of a sudden looks like it was issued by CNNIC, you've got some problems.
Yep. Once again, it gets to the point of who do you trust and what does trust mean? The public really doesn't understand what trust means. They too often confuse it with attribution. They've been told that this person is exactly who he says it is. They say, oh, good. That's like somebody standing at the door and says, Joe Blow here is truly Joe Blow. Open the door. And that's all they know. They open the door, and Joe Blow is a psychotic with a gun who shoots the guy and kills him. It doesn't mean they're trustworthy. It merely means they are known, and you can find out later who it was in fact, if the attribution actually works.
But you're not going to know because your browser bar is going to stay green and there's shiny little padlocks all over it. I mean, this is a big problem, and people should be really looking at whether or not there is a threat to their business and a threat to their communications.
Yes.
from state actors in China. Yep. And they should be removing those certificates.
Yes, this is back to my first point, that our society has become too complex. There's too many interwoven interdependencies, between national players, corporate players, individuals around the world to really be able to sort out and untangle all these interdependencies for actual trust relationships to evolve that you can work with. You were thinking at one point of discussing, can you simplify this because we have one computer doing all these things for us, or very complex telephones that are now mini browsers as well as telephones as well as email servers and stuff, and can you use special purpose equipment to handle this, you know, simplify the issue? Yes, simplification is good. So if I had a device that only did email, only through a signed path of people that I had a chance to elect and nominate for trust, you know, can you do this? The answer is yes, and you'd be better off, but not for very long, and it would not be marketable because it would not be convenient.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, I think the jury's out on that. We've got to wait and see if devices like, the iPad do well. Certainly things like the iPod Touch and the iPhone are much more controlled environments where choice has actually been removed from the consumer, and yet they're fantastic commercial successes.
Yes, but not from the vendor. From the consumer, yes, but not from the vendor. And he still needs to tack in enough services to make him look appealing to the customers who want to buy.
So you're arguing that you still need to offer multifunction capabilities to make these things appealing?
To the naive consumer, yes. And the consumer will always be naive. So there's only a certain minimal floor of trust you're going to be able to build up for most consumers. A really robust product that'll save your tush is going to be a niche market thing, possibly purchased by major corporations for their more sensitive employees that can really damage the company. And the user is not going to be happy using those toys.
Mm.
They don't let him do as much as he would like to do. He's going to want to sneak his own phone in anyway. He's human. He wants it all fast and easy through one device that he's been trained on.
There's one thing, Brian, just going back to the inclusion of Chinese organizations' root certs in browsers. There's one thing that I find quite interesting about this, which is that this whole thing has come up over the inclusion of CNNIC's cert. Okay, now, if the thing that I find funny here is, have you ever heard of the Shanghai Digital Certificate Authority?
I don't track this stuff closely.
They have had a root cert in there for a long, long time. So this is an issue that's been around for a while. And what I find interesting about this is now that CNNIC's one is going to go in, there's a huge outcry. Well, not a huge outcry, but Mozilla developers are getting into a big flap about it. And there's been a lot of blogs and stuff talking about it. But I can't help but think that this is related to the growing alarm over the publicity of attacks like the Google thing.
Yeah, there's good news and bad news. The public awareness of sensitivity to the issue is probably a good thing. What to do about it is far more complex to figure out. And to be fair, let's not just pick on China. Turns out that Brazil is also in there and has been for a few months at least. Spain is in there. I'm sure the UK. There are other nation states also in there as certificate authorities.
But these are nation states that do not directly control all commerce. These are nation states that don't have grotesque human rights violations on their records. These are nation states that don't have.
You're beginning to define your trust model. Bravo. It's a little late.
So, I mean, this is my concern with it. And, you know, I actually had a conversation with someone from a vendor about this. And they said, well, you know, as if the NSA hasn't, had access to similar sorts of signing capability in the past to man-in-the-middle people in America or whatever. I said, yeah, but, you know, those guys have more checks and balances on them than the People's Republic of China. This is the problem in the trust model. It's not the fact that they actually have the ability to cryptographically, you know, issue certs and stuff that'll pop up as valid in browsers. It's the fact that there are no checks, no balances whatsoever on the government over there, and they control absolutely everything and have a history of spying on their people and on organizations. This is a worry to me.
And it will worry many other people too. I agree with you. But you're right. But you're coming back to defining a trust model. And you're also back to a theme we started with, both you and I. And can we get an appropriate mix of what we both call either social processes or human processes or policy integration between the nations, where there can be quid pro quos, where if you do certain things that are harmful or could be harmful to me, I have the capability to do things that are harmful to you.
Like revoke your cert.
No, more robust than that. revoke certain treaty agreements as far as favored nation status, put on export controls, put on export import controls and export tariffs.
Give Taiwan more weapons.
Uh-huh. I mean, there are many things that we've known how to do long before the internet arrived in keeping nations relatively honest with each other. And you can tie some of those things into, as you mentioned, the electronic structures that we're now weaving together too fast. You know, slow down and put a few contingencies on these. Yes, your cert can be in the pile with the rest of us, but that means you're going to comply by certain rules, international rules. And if those rules are not followed, you'll either be out or there'll be other consequences that will be painful to you to help mitigate the behavior.
Now, this is what I was getting at before. I mean, do you think that that's a realistic possibility that we'll start seeing non-technology related diplomatic responses to technology related incidents?
Do you see any other mechanism?
No, I don't.
I don't either.
No, but I'm wondering why it's not happening already. I'm wondering why there isn't a far greater diplomatic push after this Google thing.
Because the interplay between nations is very complex, and you have to be very worried about unintended consequences of whatever laws and treaties you put in place to mitigate behavior on the internet. We can look at certain current commercial processes in the flesh and paper world to model, but they don't always fly. And this is something that will need to emerge cautiously and slowly until the paperwork is in place for all the nations to confess to their citizens that they'll be bound by and they're acting on. It's all a nice mutual agreement under the United Nations or whoever, or the European Union is doing it to themselves internally, those sorts of structures being put in place. There's a model there that can be looked at. But it'll be a slow process to make sure it doesn't have too many unintended consequences on the side. And until then, there's the backroom political strong-arming and threats that nations have often done that never make it to the newspapers or the public awareness. Just the table pounding in the background until you get all the nice agreements in place that everybody can say, oh my, isn't that wonderful?
This is the war room. You can't fight in here. But there was the one thing that is not very often discussed is the fact that China has half of the world's Western intelligence agencies rattling around in its systems as well. I saw a brilliant piece that filtered through the New York Times into an Australian newspaper, a Fairfax newspaper, over the weekend about how a whole bunch of data on Chinese submarines was actually walked in a spear phishing campaign. Now, do you think that it's up to Western agencies as well to maybe pull back on some of their more interesting programs?
Yes, probably. I do not know all of them, but if it's going to be anything that will work in the long run among nations, there must be some form of parity. The stronger players may be able to twist arms a little harder, but they cannot break them. They have to be able to get an agreement that will be abided to and not surreptitiously undercut too much by all the players playing, or it won't fly.
Mm.
So we do have to make nice on the playground politically.
Brian Snow on the line from the USA there with a chat about pretty much everything. These days, Brian does consulting work, mostly business-related consulting work, and he sits on a few IT security company boards. Look, we'll be chatting to him again in March, and we're thrilled that he's happy to be interviewed by us. He's a very informed guy, shall we say. Now, it is time for this week's sponsor interview. As regular listeners would know, Risky Business is a commercial podcast, and we do these sponsor interviews to fund the show. And we have a new sponsor for 2010, one that I'm personally pretty happy to have on board because they're a, you know, very interesting company doing a lot of interesting stuff, founded by Dildog and WorldPond, Chris Weissapel and Christian Ryu. Vericode are our sponsor. Now, these guys make tools to help companies secure their code. So if you are in the business of making sure that your apps, that your organization's apps are kosher, so to speak, or halal, if that's your bag, go have a look at vericode.com and see if there's anything there that could be of assistance. Now, the team at Vericode also gets to do some pretty cool research. And the company's senior researcher, Tyler Shields, has been fooling around with BlackBerries. We actually had Chris Eng from Vericode on the show in a feature interview last year, talking about his reactions to that BlackBerry malware that got pushed out into devices in the UAE by the carrier. It was like lawful intercept software. And, you know, they indicated at that time they were looking into BlackBerries. Well, here it is. So Tyler actually did a demo of some badware that he's written at ShmooCon. Was that like last week or the week before? So I got him on the line and I asked him to tell us more.
There's a number of different things you could do with it. I broke the command structure up into three different sections. We had a section called dumpers, a section called listeners, and a section for exfiltrators. Starting with the exfiltrators, we could send data off your phone using a number of different methods, in particular email, SMS, TCP, and UDP connections, among others. And then we had, of the other two classes, dumpers and listeners, we could dump your contacts, your emails, your GPS coordinates, and then we had listeners, where we could actually in real time monitor inbound and outbound SMS, inbound and outbound email, as well as your ongoing GPS coordinates updated every X number of seconds, like every 5 seconds, and track you as you moved around. So we could pretty much get anything off of your BlackBerry that was of interest to us.
So you could pretty much do anything with the BlackBerry that the user could?
Within reason, yep, pretty darn close.
Were there any inherent obstacles to actually, you know, getting that, well, I will call it malware, but getting that malware onto the device? I mean, I know that BlackBerry code is signed. Was there any drama getting your code signed?
So there's obviously a couple different hurdles actually getting the malware installed, and there's different hurdles for creating it. From a creation standpoint, the code signing was essentially a non-issue. It does require code signing to access a lot of the APIs that we were trying to use for this piece of malware that we were going to create a proof of concept for. However, the gating factor was really $20 and $20 American and filling out a web form. Once you did that, you had your own signing key within about 48 hours, and that's really trivial to anonymously grab as necessary to get anonymous keys too. So once you use the keys to sign the code that you've created, BlackBerry can't withdraw the key from a signed binary. So once you've signed the binary and published it, anybody can use that binary on their device without fear of BlackBerry ever stopping it. What BlackBerry can do is stop you from signing future pieces of code with your key. So they can disable future signs for you, but that's it.
So you're telling me that their key revocation process won't actually revoke already signed code?
That's correct. That's
wow.
Correct. They can only stop you from signing future code.
So what's the actual point of having a key revocation system at all?
Right. So their key revocation system is primarily just to determine and track who is using specific sets of APIs and kind of have a signature on who wrote specific pieces of code, pieces of binary. But that's essentially it. Their goal was never to have the ability to revoke a signed binary from running on your system.
Don't you think that would be a goal worth aspiring to?
It would be a nice thing, but that's actually very problematic and difficult to do at the handheld level. It would just be a very large undertaking for them. There's a bunch of other ways that they could make this. Let me take a step back. The BlackBerry platform as a whole is a very secure platform. What I've demonstrated with this code is really that you can access data from within a single sandbox in a pretty open fashion. So the real threat here is more applications doing one thing or saying they're going to do one thing and then doing something malicious in the background. So as far as installation methods go, the most dangerous way of getting this type of spyware onto your system would be a malicious application developer either creating an application, getting it into the BlackBerry App Store that does some of this stuff on the backside but has a facade of like a video game.
Mm-mm. So how would you actually socially engineer someone into installing a BlackBerry application? I don't personally own one, so I'm not sure what the process is like.
Sure. So there's a couple different ways. You can install what's called over-the-air, the OTA installation for applications. And the general concept there is you get somebody to use their BlackBerry browser to go to your website and download your package and install it. The other way would be you could install it by compromising the computer that they plug their BlackBerry into and using the Java loader system on their PC to install it. And last but certainly not least, the most obvious way and the most dangerous way is to create a program like a tic-tac-toe game or some other basic game that has the malware behind it, and then you get that game uploaded to the application store that BlackBerry owns and let the targets download it themselves.
Mm-hmm. Now, were there any surprises that got thrown up during the course of this research? I mean, was there something that you saw that thought, oh, that's really a problem? Or was it all pretty much what you expected?
It was all pretty much what I expected. There were a couple of little quirky things that I had to kind of figure out to bypass. Like when you, for whatever reason, when you SMS in a email address in the BlackBerry platform, they actually take the at symbol and modify it in memory so that I couldn't directly use that incoming email address as a command and control channel. I had to kind of modify that. But other than some weird kind of idiosyncratic things like that, it was all very straightforward because I'm using the published APIs that RIM makes available. Mm. I'm not using any kind of hacks or attacks here. I'm not using any exploits. These are just examples of what spyware would look like in the wild and some of the pieces of functionality that are available to applications if the application developers choose to actually use them.
If you found some sort of flaw in like the BlackBerry browser, would you be able to drop your stuff onto the handheld that way?
Yeah, that would be a worst case scenario. If we end up finding some kind of flaws in the BlackBerry browser or in the BlackBerry operating system itself that we could exploit, then this would be a perfect payload to be dropping onto a target device.
Now, how stealthy would it be once it actually arrived on the device? Is it one of those things where you would see it as some sort of application, like, completely harmless, don't look here, .app, or would it be something that would be a little bit more, stealthy?
Sure. It's largely dependent on a couple things. The version of the operating system itself actually makes a difference. RIM and BlackBerry, for the version 5.0 of their operating system, disabled the ability to install these applications in a very stealthy fashion, which we could do in any of the 4X versions by setting it as a system module and an auto-run module. When we install it, it would run hidden, and you wouldn't actually see it as a running application. You would see it in the modules list if you knew where to look, but you wouldn't see it if you held down on the menu key and looked for running applications. You also wouldn't see it in the download folder, which is where it normally would install to. But in 5.0, they disabled some of that functionality, so it's much harder to hide in 5.0. However, like I said, the more interesting attack vector isn't necessarily my whole spyware proof of concept in one fell swoop. The more interesting attack vector is to take one or two small components of my spyware and hide it behind something that's innocuous looking.
So you really think this is like, something best embedded in the lolcats app?
Yes, exactly.
All right, because we know people can't resist funny cats.
Exactly. And if you look at the slide deck that I presented at ShmooCon, I actually give a half a dozen examples where these types of things have happened in application stores such as iTunes, as well as the Google Android Marketplace, and how this is really kind of the future of where spyware is going to go, targeting the mobile platform, because the mobile platform has just as much significant data as a PC, a personal PC these days, especially with corporate emails and corporate contacts, that it's such an interesting way to attack an individual or to attack a corporation that I would be surprised if the cyber criminals out there don't target the mobile malware space significantly in 2010.
Well, yeah, I mean, we've been expecting that one for a while, though, you know?
Yep, but if you look at the rapid increase in a couple things in the last a year or so of smartphones really being picked up, and specifically with the BlackBerry market targeting the end consumer now to compete with iPhone, as well as the iPhone kind of march to leadership in the last year or two, we're really seeing everyone starting to get their hands on these smartphones that contain a lot of data. And it's really kind of becoming the future area that people are going to be storing their personal and private data on.
Now, in terms of a targeted attack, how hard would it be to, say, do a bit of recon on a target? Say it's an organization, they've got a BlackBerry Enterprise server, all of that sort of stuff. You find out they're using a particular app. How hard is it to actually embed this stuff into an app that already exists? I mean, can you actually dummy up a bad version of an app and then replace your bad version for their legitimate version relatively easily?
Yeah, that would be difficult. You'd have to figure out a way to recompile the application or have the source code to the application, because you can't necessarily modify the application itself because it'll fail the signature checks. So it'd be hard to do it at a binary modification level. But I think the real interesting risk is more of the inserting it into an app store and letting them download itself, because If we look at the Droid, I don't know, did you hear about the Droid 09 example?
No.
Okay, so a guy, 09 Droid, created a bunch of about 50 different applications for the Google Android marketplace and got them onto the marketplace that were essentially front ends to banking applications like the Royal Bank of Canada, Chase, BB&T.
Oh, nice. So instead of using your pesky browser, here's an app. It'll do it easily, and you enter in your password, and we'll save it for you.
Exactly. And there was no proof of malicious activity, but that's the perfect model of attack right there. In their defense, Google Android pulled it fairly quickly, but even in that short amount of time, there were significant downloads, enough that that at least one bank issued a fraud warning for the application, stating that the app may have been designed to compromise user credentials.
Yeah, there was another one with the iPhone. Well, it's not dodgy, but I mean, everyone raves about all of these password saving apps. So that if you want to like log onto here or log onto there, just, you know, you put all your passwords into this application and it saves you heaps of time, Tyler.
Yeah, and it saves the attacker heaps of time, too.
All right, mate, that is all we're going to have time for now, but thank you very much for joining Risky Business to have a chat about the latest with BlackBerry malware.
Fantastic, thank you.
Tyler Shields of Vericode there with a look at BlackBerry Badware in this week's sponsor interview. That's it for this week's show. Hopefully tomorrow I'll be posting an interview with Assistant Commissioner Neil Gagan of the Australian Federal Police. That's one to look out for, so go subscribe to that feed if you haven't. And that's it for this week's show. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.